India running late, so I'll try my best to catch up with some time. Now, first of all, let me say it's an absolute honor and pleasure for me to be here. My joy is actually twofold. First of all, it's a fantastic conference, and it's, again, an honor to speak here. But secondly, this is home for me. And I grew up in a town which is just 40 k's from here. And I'm actually amidst classmates and teachers here. So it's my first opportunity to talk in front of all of you. Now, yeah, what I'm going to talk today is about... what I'll do is I'll do a very, very quick practical overview on osteomyelitis, of the food and the diabetes. And also talk about this program which we run in our hospital where intravenous antibiotics is provided at home for patients to keep them away from the hospital. And I don't really have much disclosures in the way of disclosures. Now, history fascinates me. Not when I was at school, but when I look at medicine, it's quite fascinating. And if you go through the history in detail, we see descriptions of bone infection described in many ways, right from the time of Hippocrates. But it wasn't until 1944, time of Nelaton, and he's the one who first coined the term osteomyelitis. And surgery was the only therapeutic option at that time. I've got this picture from the internet, where Nelaton is standing next to one of his customers whose legs seem to have been amputated. But interestingly, the patient doesn't seem that disappointed with it all. And if you look closely at Nelaton's face, you can see a sense of pride. Probably because he saved this guy's life because he had a 30% chance of dying in those days, the mortality rate. And this was the case until the advent of penicillin in 1940. Now, we all know that there's an unholy type of nexus between diabetes and osteomyelitis. And just to give us a rough indication, if you are a diabetic, you've got a 10% chance of a foot infection in your life. And data from NHS would say, if you have a puncture wound in a diabetic foot, the chance of osteomyelitis is about 30%, so quite a significant problem. And the reason for that is multifactorial. You start with the neuropathy and the vasculopathy, and the foot deformity is secondary to that. And there's also this factor of diabetics being prone for infection because of impaired neutrophil and macrophage function. There's also impaired wound healing, like we saw in the previous talk. There's reduced fibroblast function, and which is important for wound healing. And there's also dysregulation of what's called the matrix metalloproteinases, which is again important for keratin migration and again wound healing. So, and in terms of mode of spread, mainly there are three types. The hematogenous spread, that's what you usually see in infections of the large joints, like hip joints, infection of the shaft of femur, and direct inoculation, what you get with trauma and surgery, where the organism is directly inoculated into the bone. But when it comes to diabetes, the contiguous spread is the most commonest way you contract infection. And most often you have vascular insufficiency associated with it. So the first point I want to make is when you see osteomyelitis, think about vascular insufficiency because often it goes together. But in clinical practice, this is what you're faced with. So you've got a patient in front of you who's got an ulcer, which looks like that. And the question is there osteomyelitis underneath it or not? So what are the clinical indicators that, the clinical tools that you can use to investigate if there's osteomyelitis there or not? The first, which is the probe to bone test, is probably the best. There are lots of studies confirming this fact, and depending on which one you look at, the sensitivity and specificity ranges around about 80 to 90%. So quite a powerful tool and a simple tool, if used properly, to assess for osteomyelitis. And as shown in the picture, you really have to use a metal probe and feel for the bone to get that kind of specificity and sensitivity. So that the technique is also important. Now, if the bone is visible, that's also quite a good indicator. And an ulcer more than 2 centimeters in diameter is another one. And as you go low, I found these other indicators in the literature, probably not as good as the first, but still probably quite useful. So that's the high ESR, an ulcer more than 2 weeks, and an ulcer depth of more than 3 millimeters, this has been shown in the literature that it's predictive of osteomyelitis as well. Now, coming back to the growth to bone test, it's, again, it's, there's another dimension to it. This is a patient we saw in the clinic a couple of weeks ago, and we knew that she had infection in the metatarsal pharyngeal joint, the first metatarsal pharyngeal joint. But when she presented, her skin looked reasonably intact, and when you actually probed it, she actually had a centimeter and a half sinus beneath it. So again, probing is quite a powerful tool to uncover pathology which is not that obvious. Moving on to imaging, again, it's useful. X-rays is obviously the first line still, and it's quite useful, but if there is an obvious abnormality there. But often in the early setting, you may not see any abnormality in the X-ray picked up early. And that's why when you look at trials, the sensitivity is quite low in the acute setting, as low as 14%. Specificity is slightly better, obviously, if you see something that's useful. So, which is why if you have the luxury of having these other modalities, MRI is probably the best. It's highly sensitive, and it also gives good anatomic definition of the bone as well as soft tissue. And here I've got some pictures here. That's the T2 image showing fluid collection. Fluid collection just there. And that's again another image showing again the fluid collection which is quite well delineated there in one of the T2 images. And below there, you can see cortical disruption of the bone there. So it gives a lot of information, but one of the best information you get from MRIs is actually bone edema. Now, bone edema is a good and a bad thing, because probably bone edema is the first indication of underlying osteomyelitis. But it's also the first indication of many other pathologies as well. So it's key that you put that information in the right clinical setting. And the pattern of bone edema is also quite important. If you see edema in a bone which is contiguous with an ulcer, well, then you can probably infer that it's probably osteomyelitis. Whereas if you don't have an ulcer and if you see the bone in a distribution where you usually get Charcot's arthropathy, well, that's more indicative of that. But if you don't see any bone edema, it's a good negative predictor. So you can probably rule out. But again, I don't know how available MRIs is in the general population. I'm sure in big centers you can easily avail it, but not in smaller places. CT scanning is also equally good when it comes to defining bony details, but not as good as MRI when it comes to soft tissue and showing bone edema. Now, nuclear scans, it depends on, again, the institution you work. Probably not as good as MRI when it comes to sensitivity and specificity. And amongst those, it's triple-plate bone scans, gallium scans, and amongst those, probably the best would be the white cell bone scan, the Indian one-month scan. But again, it depends on your center and the expertise of your nuclear physician. And in our place, we don't usually use bone nuclear scans that often. But if you look at literature, there's a good meta-analysis by Kapoor, which again highlights the fact that MRI scan is probably the best modality you can use to assess a diabetic foot. When it comes to microbiology, as I said, it's usually contiguous, the infection spreads contiguously, and because of that, the infection tends to be polymicrobial. Superficial swabs is not of that much of a benefit, I would say, because of the colonization of the diabetic foot with multiple organisms. If you just take a superficial swab, it's hard to work out which one is actually causing the osteomyelitis to make that. But there is another entity called qualitative swab, which is done by debriding the wound to some extent, cleaning it, and then expressing some tissue out of the floor of the ulcer and swab it. And that may provide better information than just a superficial swab. But if possible, it's always good to have a bone tissue as microbiology. Most often you can do it when you do the surgical debridement, you can take piece of bone for culture. But if not, a percutaneous streptomycin bone biopsy would be very useful. And you do the routine culture. And in areas where there's more prevalence of mycobacterial infection and fungal infection, it's probably worthwhile to include that as well in your culture studies. Inflammatory markers are also useful. Probably CRP is the best indicator. However, I should say that in some diabetics, you won't see a high CRP even though they have osteomyelitis. So if it is high, it helps. If it's low, still you have to think more about it and think along with clinically. Now, I'm sure most of the clinicians would agree that Staph aureus is probably the most respected organism when it comes to diabetic osteomyelitis, or any osteomyelitis in fact. So that's why I've given a full slide for that. But you see most, a lot of other organisms also in the body, like strep, MRSA. MRSA is becoming more and more prevalent in certain areas of the world. Unfortunately, not in ours, and from what I understand from Sunday, it's not that. It's just emerging as a problem here. So. But you see facultative anaerobes, gram-negative, pseudomonas, E. coli, bacteroids, all of that. It's a pretty picture, isn't it? Unlike the diabetic ulcer. Now, when it comes to therapy, it's very important to be surgical debridement and offloading, and I'm sure there are a lot of sessions on that in this conference. And revascularization is also very important because of what I said, with vascular insufficiency can coexist with osteomyelitis. Now, a quick word about antibiotics. There's a question whether oral antibiotics is as good as IV antibiotics or not. If you go evidence-based, there's not a lot of data to support you. This is a meta-analysis looking at all the trials done, oral versus intravenous. And it did show equivalence of certain antibiotics like ciprofloxacin, cefloxacin, and alprazolam compared to intravenous antibiotics. But the problem with these studies are the numbers are small, and they're not done exclusively in diabetics. So what we really don't know, we don't really have good studies to show that oral is equivalent to intravenous in significant osteomyelitis. And I'm sure in certain centers, even we also treat certain patients with oral antibiotics, so there's expert evidence is different. But when you look at the evidence, I think we still need more evidence for that. So until that time, we've chosen to stick with intravenous antibiotics if possible, if the osteomyelitis is significant enough. So 4 to 6 weeks of intravenous antibiotics is still the standard of care. And if you think about empiric treatment because you don't have microbiology, think about a broad spectrum cover because of the polymicrobial infection. And also consider MRSA if your area has got more MRSA, it's prevalent in MRSA. Now, it's all good that you can say, okay, 4 to 6 weeks of antibiotics is the best way, but what about the cost? And cost is the same, here, the patient or in some other places like ours, it's cost for the taxpayer. So that's why we came up with this program called Out and About IV Therapy Program. And essentially what we do is we accept patients in a sort of a virtual ward. So they're actually discharged from the hospital, but they're still under the care of the Out and About team, which provides intravenous treatment at home. It was started back in 1995, and so far there have been 4,000 patients going through this program. The database was kept only since 2001, and when I actually looked at it, there were only 86 patients with diabetic osteomyelitis in it, which means that this program also looks after a lot of other patients like cystic fibrosis and pneumonias and osteomyelitis of other reasons. So it's not exclusively diabetic osteomyelitis that will get looked after. It's run by the infectious diseases department of our hospital in conjunction with the endocrinologist. So all the patients who we refer is screened by the ID, the infectious diseases physician, and he determines whether this particular patient needs intravenous or oral antibiotics. So he takes a clinical decision based on the findings. And there's a team, again, by the comprising of the ID physician, the registrar, and the nurses, and the pharmacist who oversees this program. And before the patient leaves the hospital, he gets a central venous catheter. Most often it's a PIC line. PIC stands for peripherally inserted central catheter. But sometimes, if there's peripheral access, or a subclavian line. And these are the devices that is commonly used. The most commonly used device is what's called the Baxter infuser. Most of the antibiotics we use can be infused through these infusers over a 24-hour period. But if any of the antibiotics are unstable for that 24-hour period, then you can use this Baxter volumetric pump, which can provide the dose on a BD basis. And if the infusion amount is large, then use a CAD pump, but this is very rarely used. And this is the antibiotic, spread of antibiotics. So out of those 86 patients, we used 104 antibiotics, and by far the commonest antibiotic used was Thymentin. And again, suggesting that the polymicrobial picture of diabetic osteomyelitis, Thymentin has got a broad cover. It's got a very good gram-positive, gram-negative, as well as anaerobic cover. Followed by vancomycin, suggesting that, almost 12 patients of ours had MRSA in their wound. And then Flucrox, which is for methicillin-sensitive staph aureus. We're slowly shifting to Tacrosolin rather than Thymentin, so in a few years' time, you'll see that line staying the same and the Tacrosolin going up purely for to save some cost. And that's the outcome. So out of the 86 patients who were treated, 41, which is about 48%, had a successful outcome. And what I mean by success, or what you mean by success, is that predetermined goal the ID physician takes when he first accepts the patient. The goal would be different in different patients. So maybe in one patient the goal is a complete cure. For the other patient it could be stabilization of the infection with intravenous antibiotics and then long-term treatment with oral antibiotics, just to give you an example. So the goals are different, but would be the same if the patient were to stay in the hospital or at home. So this data is actually 6 months data on that success criteria. And yeah, close to 50% met that success criteria in 6 months' time. And almost 17% did not meet and were unsuccessful, which means the goals were not met and they had to come back to the hospital or they died or whatever. Now this is where you need to improve. We don't have data on almost 33%. And partly it's because during the initial phase of data collection, the data collector was not, not comprehensive in doing that. And it's also partly because over the last few months we've had an increase in the number of patients and they haven't quite met the 6 months follow-up period, and that's why it's given us an unknown. So over a period of time I would expect this, if we collect those data as well, I'm sure this 50% would be much more than that, but at least 50%. And when it comes to complications, this is complications from PICC lines, and we're doing really well compared to the international literature. These are the commonest complications you can get with a peripherally inserted catheter, so phlebitis, blockage, malpositioning of the catheter, thrombosis, damage, accidental removal, and that was interesting because accidental removal happened twice commonly while they were in the hospital as opposed to when they were at home. So the catheter was safer at home rather than when it was in the hospital. Infection and all that. So when you look at the observed complication rate, it's better than what's been shown in the literature so far. So, and that's another interesting fact. What I'm showing here is the person responsible for the home IV therapy. And the first line, which is in blue in circles, that's the healthcare worker. And down here, you've got the patient, the carer, or a combination of the carer looking after their IV home treatment. So when this program was started in 1995, close to 90% of the time, it was the healthcare worker who was primarily responsible and was actually doing the infusion. And close to 15%, it was done by the patient and the patient carer or a combination. But as time went by, it may suggest the healthcare worker got more lazy, but that's not the case. We managed to empower the patient as well as the carer to take up their treatment by themselves. So now, and the healthcare, the intervention from the healthcare of those became much lesser over a period of time. So what that enabled us to do was, you could, the healthcare worker could accept more patients from the hospital to be managed under this program. And when it comes to cost, the mean length of stay in this program was 22 days. And if they were to stay in hospital, it would have costed the system about $700 per day. But if the carer or the patient themselves looked after their home IV treatment, the cost was even less than a third, or close to a fourth. And that actually includes the equipment and the staff, the nurse's salary and everything. And if the healthcare worker had to administer it directly, it's still close to a third of the price. So in conclusion, I think the first point is that if you see a diabetic foot ulcer, always consider osteomyelitis. And I give you a few tips, clinical tips that you could use to investigate for that, especially the probe to bone test, which is probably the best. Now, if you can afford imaging studies, MRI scan would be the best, followed by a CT scan. Whenever possible, do a bone biopsy and culture. And home IV treatment is a cost-effective way of treating infection that require long-term IV antibiotics. And that's it. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Doctor, for the presentation. I think he has given a presentation which we'll have to think whether it's applicable in this part of the world. I think from continuous center line to send the patient home and do it there. We also send patients home and ask them to take twice or thrice daily bolus injection by a nearby nurse or somebody feeding it, having a peripheral line kept to do. And it is open for comments, questions.
Yes, sir.
MRI is an important point for diagnosing osteomyelitis. Yeah. Where would bone biopsy fall into that? When would you put bone biopsy in that line of treatment?
I would say bone biopsy would be maybe just before, even if you're considering osteomyelitis in underneath an ulcer, you could do bone biopsies straight on for microbiological purposes, as for diagnostic purposes. But even before that, if your level of suspicion is low, then you can probably do an MRI scan. If you don't see an edema, I don't know if you'd really need a biopsy on top of that. But if you, I'm sure if the bone marrow edema is due to, say, a Charcot's foot versus osteomyelitis, probably that's when you could consider a bone biopsy.
I think in our setting, we rely more on bone probing and taking a correctized for culture. Then you get both. You get confirmation for osteomyelitis, and you know the organism and the sensitivity pattern also.
You mean bone biopsy?
Not biopsy, curettage.
Curettage.
Okay. Same one. You have to go for debridement of the wound, so in the theater you do it. And the MRI, as you know, is in this part. It is available, only thing is expensive.
Yes.
Dr. Bhabha?
I think it's a good modality if we can manage in developing countries this at-home IV antibiotics. I think a lot of cost will be saved, that's true. It's only a question of logistics.
I think so. I thought it could be relevant because if you formulate, I mean, systems over always amazes me. We think it's not possible, but you know, a place like Amrita, I think this is probably the best place where you can even think about it. And if there is a way you can prevent infections in this long term, manage leaving the IV line. Yeah, I think it's, it may cost, it might be cost, definitely cost effective for the patient as well, rather than staying in the hospital.
That's true. Any other question?
So we'll take questions after the session.
Yeah, okay.
I thank Dr. Christie. And I request Dr. Ajit Kumar Verma to give a memento from our side.
Next speaker is Dr. David Nielsen. He is going to talk on various modalities.